For us to engage in conscious co-creation with great spirit, how will we prepare ourselves for this exciting and unprecedented time in Earth's history? Peter Tung has dedicated over 20 years of his life's work to exploring that which is beyond understanding. The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Health and Wellness Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericahealth.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management. Welcome to The Vital Life, Awakening Your Full Potential, hosted by Dr. Carolyn Coker Ross. The Vital Life will expand your understanding of how to live life fully and joyfully by making conscious choices that promote and maintain vitality in all areas of your life. Now, here is your host, Dr. Carolyn Ross.
Welcome to The Vital Life. Today we have a wonderful show planned for you. It seems like this month of September, we're exploring a lot about addictions. And my guest today is Dr. Gabor Mate. He is a physician and best-selling author whose interests include mind-body unity and health, illness, and the treatment of addictions. He regularly addresses health professionals, educators, and lay audiences throughout North America. He's a gifted psychotherapist. He leads transformative seminars several times a year, and he has worked in family practice, palliative care, and addictions. His most recent book, which we'll be discussing on today's show, is called In the Realm of Hungry Ghosts, Close Encounters with Addiction, and it won the Hubert Evans Prize for Literary Nonfiction. Welcome to the show, Dr. Mate.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
So I'm just curious. It seems like your interest in medicine are pretty varied. How did you begin to work with this population who had addictions in Canada?
I live in Vancouver, where there's a neighborhood called the Downtown East Side, which is generally notorious as North America's most concentrated area of drug use. Mm. Now, so within a few square block radius, you have thousands of people who are dependent on injectable substances, heroin, cocaine, and crystal meth, and, of course, alcohol, tobacco, and other drugs. Now, I've been in family practice for 20 years, and in that period, I had some addicted clients in my practice, mm-hmm. and at some point, I also got interested in attention deficit disorder, with which I was diagnosed at age 52.
Really?
I was my first book actually, and ADD is a major risk factor for addictions for reasons we could discuss later, perhaps.
Yeah.
And what struck me throughout my medical practice is that childhood experiences, particularly of the adverse kind, have long-term effects on people. So outcomes such as cancer, rheumatoid arthritis, ADD, and mental illness in general, and addiction specifically, has a lot to do with how people experience life in their early years. And so that consciousness began to dawn on me more and more as I pursued my medical career. And at some point, I just had this call to work with that particular population, all the more so since not only did I see them as the people most needing medical care in our society, but also I recognized in myself many of the same patterns that I saw in them. So it was both a medical inspiration, I suppose, that drew me to that population, but also the knowledge that I shared some of their dynamics.
Can you say more about what you saw as the dynamics that you shared with the addiction?
Well, at the heart of addiction always is terrific emotional pain, and nobody chooses to be an addict. It's the addiction is an attempt to solve a problem, not to get one. Of course, it's many problems. Mm-hmm. The problem that the addiction is designed to solve, or at least unconsciously intends to solve, is the problem of emotional distress and pain. and a sense of insufficiency and emptiness that you try to fill from the outside. Now, I haven't done that in my own life with substances, but I've certainly done it with behaviors such as work and shopping. And that distress and that emptiness, I could certainly relate to. And it's just that the clients that I ended up working with who are dependent on heroin and cocaine would have the emptiness and the pain in higher degrees than I did, and that was the only difference.
So you, from your point of view, it's just a matter of degree?
I think addictions are to be located on a continuum that one sees throughout our society. And when you actually look at addictions, whether you look at the brain biology, the brain physiology, or the psychological dynamics, it's very similar whether you're a workaholic or whether you're a heroin addict, whether you're not a gambler or whether you're dependent on cocaine. And these are matters of degree, and also, if you look at people's lives, matters of degrees of suffering, I suppose.
So is your understanding or your view of addictions different, do you think, from the conventional view, which holds that, you know, it's really a genetic issue that causes addictions?
Well, the broad social view, the broadest social view is not even that it's genetic. It's society looks on addictions as kind of a choice that somebody makes, hence the punitive response to it. So, you know, see, if somebody has a genetic disease, why put them in jail?
Right.
You know, so the fundamental belief that drives social attitudes and the war on drugs and the whole legal approach to addiction is that this is a choice, a bad decision that somebody deliberately makes and need to be either deterred from it or punished for it. Now, you're quite right, though. The medical perspective is more that it's a genetic disease that, you know, it runs in families, you inherit the gene, and then you're prone to be addicted. And I don't see it that way at all. While there might be genetic predispositions, the common factor in all addictions, and the research is not even controversial, I mean, it's just clear that the more adversity you experienced in childhood, the greater the risk of addiction. So in the downtown east side where I worked, in my 14 years of work with this population, I never met a single woman who had not been sexually abused. And the men had all suffered degrees of abuse, some sexual, physical, abandonment, neglect, all kinds of traumas, not just one time, but repeatedly throughout their childhood. And that, for a whole set of reasons we could discuss, then sets up the predisposition to addiction. Any genetic factors that may be present are superseded by the environment, so that studies have shown, for example, that in children who may have some genes that predispose to addiction, if they're brought up in a nurturing family, those genes are not expressed. Those genes are not activated. So the key factor is never the genes in addiction. And of course, my profession and your profession, the medical profession, is very addicted, if I may coin a phrase, to the genetic perspective for a whole lot of reasons.
Yeah, why do you think that is? Because that is puzzling to me.
Well, partly there's a really bad misunderstanding of the twin studies that buttress the genetic perspective. But more than that, as I think you as an integrative physician will probably agree with me, that the medical profession, by and large, despite the scientific evidence, still very much separates the mind from the body. And it separates the individual from the environment. So rather than seeing that human beings develop from conception onwards and remain until death in a dynamic interaction with the environment, particularly the psychological, social, emotional environment, we see them as discrete individuals. And so that rather than seeing the source of problems in a person's relationship with the environment, we see them in the individual as if they're separate from that environment. And then, of course, we left the genes. So that's one reason, that mind-body separation. And of course, you know, so we separate the individual from the environment. We also separate the individual internally into a collection of organs rather than seeing that our emotional lives and our organic processes are completely intertwined. In fact, they can't even be separated, either theoretically or biologically, in a live person.
I think the most shocking part of medicine for me in the treatment of addictions is the ongoing stigma that's placed on addictions. In people who may have been sober for, I have patients and friends with history of addiction and family members, and they may have been sober for over a decade, but when they enter the medical system, they're still treated like addicts and treated poorly.
That's the contradiction I was referring to earlier. Even if we believe, which I don't, but even if we believe that addiction was a genetically determined condition, then how possibly can we condemn people for it?
Yes.
What choice does anybody have or what genes they inherit?
Mm-hmm.
Now, so in fact, the moral judgment, the opprobrium that is cast upon addicts is very much based on this belief that people are choosing to be addicted. So there's a contradiction there. Because, I mean, even if we, you know, if it's genetic, let's at least not condemn people for it. But, of course, the reality is that it's not even genetic, that it's very much depends on what a person's life experiences are. So if you look at my clients and the high degrees of abuse amongst that particular population, which, by the way, is validated in large-scale population studies in the States called the famous Adverse Childhood Experiences Studies.
I want you to talk a little bit more about that.
If people were abused and traumatized as children, and if that then leads to certain lines of brain development and personality development, how can you blame people for it? Did anybody choose to be sexually traumatized when they were 5 years old?
Yeah, exactly. Well, talk a little bit about the ACE study, because since it first came out, just found that to be such a fascinating study and really important.
Very important. In fact, if we actually took its implications to heart, we would have to change our whole approach to how we practice medicine.
Yeah.
The Adverse Childhood Experiences studies were performed in California, and I know you're interested in eating disorders.
Mm-hmm.
And the lead researchers were actually working in an obesity clinic.
Right.
And they found that with a rigorous regimen of diet and positive feedback, they could help people lose weight. But what do you imagine they couldn't do?
They couldn't help them keep it off.
They couldn't help them keep it off.
Mm-hmm.
And then they did what medical doctors rarely do. They listened to the patients. And Dr. Vincent Felitti, who's one of the lead researchers, told me that one patient said to him, "Don't you get it? I'm eating to soothe my pain." And then he started gathering the stories of these clients. One story of trauma after another.
Yeah.
So that the eating was people's attempt. It was an addictive attempt to soothe pain and to suppress distress. And that then led to the adverse childhood experiences studies. And an adverse childhood experience is physical, or sexual, or emotional abuse, the loss of a parent through death, through being jailed, or rancorous divorce, a parent being addicted, violence in the family, mental illness in the family. For each of these adverse childhood experiences, they looked at something like 15,000 adults in California. For each of these adverse childhood experiences, the risk of addiction went up exponentially, so went up 2 to 4-fold. By the time a male child has had 6 of these, his risk of having become an injection-dependent substance addict was 4,600% greater than that of a male child with no such experiences, a 46-fold increase. So the risk of smoking went up, the risk of addictions went up, the risk of obesity went up, the risk of eating disorders went up, the risk of autoimmune diseases went up, the risk of cancer went up, the risk of antisocial behaviors went up, the risk of relationship problems went up, the risk of early death went up.
Mm-hmm.
Again, all based on early childhood experiences. And most saliently, the addiction was clearly shown to be related to the degree of childhood trauma.
I think many people may be shocked, though, that adverse childhood experiences would be related to the risk for autoimmune diseases and cancer.
Well, that's the subject of another book of mine called When the Body Says No, Exploring the Stress-Disease Connection. And it's not, biologically it's not that shocking, because you and I know that that kind of trauma sets off, it's not just an emotional event in isolation from the body. When people are abused, it sets off physiological responses like an exaggerated stress response.
Right.
With heightened levels of adrenaline and cortisol, all kinds of changes in the immune system, all kinds of changes in the the neuropeptides, the chemicals that the nervous system secretes. Mm-hmm. And it sets up lifelong patterns of coping that are dysfunctional. People tend to suppress themselves in order to survive. And that self-suppression then, of course, leads to immune suppression or immune attack against the body. So physiologically, it's really easy to understand if you actually look at
the physiology of it,
and then the source of it. And, you know, what is known now that those early patterns really set up, for example, children who are abused will have lifelong tendency for inflammation, inflammatory particles in their bodies.
Mm-hmm.
A Canadian study showed a couple of years ago that if you're abused, your risk of cancer goes up by a factor of nearly 50%.
Mm-hmm.
No, now that's not necessarily inevitable. It depends on how you deal with it and what kind of help you get.
Mm-hmm.
But on its own, it's a risk factor. And it's not purely psychological. As I say, it has to do with the fact that you cannot separate the mind from the body.
Right. A shocking constant in and of itself there. We just have a few minutes before our first break, but the fad now in addiction treatment seems to be talking about attachment. What role do you feel attachment plays in addiction?
Well, I'm delighted to hear that it's a current trend, because attachment is the, if you're talking about the attachment, the emotional relationships between
mm-hmm.
parents and children, is that what you mean by attachment?
Yes, right.
Yeah, that's the key question in addiction.
Okay.
The fact is that we now know that the human brain actually develops an interaction with the environment,
mm-hmm.
that which circuits develop and which do not has to do with environmental input. And the biggest factor in that environmental influence on brain development is actually the quality of the attachment relationship with the parents.
Mm-hmm.
And the more stressed and distracted or troubled the parents are, the greater the difficulty the child will have in terms of brain development. And I don't know when the break is coming up, but I could certainly say a lot more about that.
Well, you have a couple more minutes, so keep going.
Okay. Well, if you look at the key circuits in addiction, which mm-hmm. don't work in the brain so well, they are the opiate circuitry. We have our internal opiates, like we have endorphins, which are the body's natural morphine-like substances. They're called endorphins, which means endogenous morphine-like substance. The endorphin apparatus that we have is designed to soothe our pain.
Mm-hmm.
It's designed to give us a sense of pleasure and reward, and is designed to maintain our attachment relationships.
Mm-hmm.
Now, attachment is key because the human child, the human infant, is the most helpless, the most immature, and the most dependent for the longest period of time of any creature on Earth.
Mm-hmm.
So that means that without the attachment relationship, we simply don't survive. We can't
right.
survive a day without our attachment relationships when we're infants. Even as adults, we're dependent on them. But as infants and children, we're absolutely helplessly dependent on them. And so that endorphin circuitry then requires the good attachments with the parents to develop. If those attachments are troubled or if the child is abused, those endorphin circuits just won't develop so well, and that person will then want that opium or that morphine-like substance from some external source. And there
okay.
you have the heroin addict.
Perfect. Okay, we're going to go to break now, and when we come back, we'll be talking more with Dr. Gabor Mate, the author of In the Realm of Hungry Ghosts, Close Encounters with Addiction on The Vital Life. Back in a moment.
Your life, your health, your network. You're listening to Voice America Health and Wellness.
Have your resolutions to lose weight fallen flat? Get serious about reaching your healthy weight and actually changing your relationship with food and your body once and for all. The Anchor Weight Management Program, developed by Dr. Carolyn Coker-Ross, is a unique whole-person approach to restoring your healthy body weight without sacrificing your joy in eating. This is a medically supervised, effective, safe, and realistic program. There are ongoing programs in the Denver area, or you can do the program at your own pace, in the privacy of your own home. For more information or to register, call 303-993-5468. That's 303-993-5468.
Step into a healthier you. Voice America Health and Wellness.
Thank you.
You're listening to The Vital Life, Awakening Your Full Potential with your host, Dr. Carolyn Coker Ross. If you have a question for Dr. Ross or her guests today, please call 1-866-472-5792. That's 1-866-472-5792. If you prefer to send an email, you can reach Dr. Ross at vitalliferadio@gmail.com. Now back to The Vital Life.
Welcome back to The Vital Life. My guest today is well-known physician and best-selling author, Dr. Gabor Mate, and we're talking about his most recent book, In the Realm of Hungry Ghost, Close Encounters with Addiction. So on the break, Dr. Mate, you were talking about that you could trace almost any illness back to attachment, which we were talking about before. We were talking about how attachment actually affects the brain and causes the brain to develop differently. So give us more information about that.
Well, again, to return to addiction, so I mentioned how the body's endorphin or internal morphine-like opiate system, which is essential for pain relief, for pleasure and reward, and for love and connection, mm-hmm. how that system develops or doesn't in relationship to the environment. And what's needed for its development is healthy, attuned, non-stressed parenting support. Mm-hmm. Now, if you look at another circuit involved in addictions, and also in ADD, of course, is the dopamine circuitry. Okay. Dopamine is another brain chemical which is essential for motivation and attention. And the dopamine circuits, if they're not flowing properly, then the person will be listless and unmotivated and difficult. They'll find it difficult to pay attention. Dopamine flows whenever we're vital or excited, vibrant, curious, exploring a novel object, seeking food, seeking a sexual partner. Now, the dopamine circuitry of motivation is the main circuitry that's triggered in all addictions, whether it's gambling or whether it's heroin. The dopamine circuitry requires the presence of non-stressed, attuned parenting caregivers. If you take infant monkeys and you measure their dopamine levels and you find them to be normal and then you separate them from their mothers, within a week or so, their dopamine levels will have fallen. So the dopamine levels in the infant depend very much on the attention and presence of the parents. Children who are brought up in homes that are highly stressed, where the parents are distracted or depressed, or worse, where the parents are abusive, their dopamine circuits won't work so properly. And guess what? When they do cocaine and crystal meth, which are stimulants that elevate dopamine levels, they feel normal for the first time in their lives. Mm-hmm. So then they're hooked.
Yeah,
it's a myth that drugs in themselves are addictive. I mean, it's obvious that they're not, because most people who try most drugs never become addicted. Most people who try alcohol never become alcoholics. Most people who eat don't develop an eating problem. So you can't say that the cause of the eating problem is the food or the alcoholism is the alcohol.
Yeah.
What you need for the disease of addiction to develop is both an addictive or potentially addictive substance or behavior, which could be almost anything in the whole world, and a susceptible individual. And the susceptible individuals are those whose childhoods were so difficult that their brain circuitry didn't develop optimally. And so most people, you can give them morphine all you want for chronic pain or acute pain, they will not be hooked on the morphine. When the pain is gone, they get off the morphine. But some people whose early life was difficult and therefore they're predisposed, they're the ones who you give morphine to and now they feel normal for the first time. Another brain circuit involved in addiction is impulse regulation. So the addict doesn't know how to say no.
Right.
So whether it's impulsive shopping, impulsive any kind of behavior or drug use, if you do brain scans on drug addicts, the commonest brain finding on the scans is that the part of the brain that regulates impulses doesn't function. Okay. Now that's the orbital frontal cortex, particularly on the right side. That, too, needs that same kind of environmental input because, again, it's no longer controversial, although not yet taught in the medical schools, that the brain develops an interaction with the environment. And as Dr. Daniel Siegel, who's a well-known psychiatrist and brain researcher and researcher at UCLA, has said, human connections make neuronal connections. In other words, human connections create the nerve connections in the brain.
Hmm.
And where those connections are troubled, so where the human connections are troubled, so will the brain connections be. And by the way, which also explains my view, why we're seeing so many more children diagnosed with all kinds of disorders.
Like ADHD.
Which is a problem of impulse control.
Yeah.
In significant ways. ADHD, oppositional defiant disorder, conduct disorders, depression, anxiety, bipolar, I mean, all kinds of stuff. Because the parenting environment, as I make clear in another couple of my books, the parenting environment in North America and in industrial society in general has become more and more stressed. It's not that parents aren't as loving or as dedicated as they used to. Excuse me one quick second. I'm sorry.
But it's probably that parents are themselves very, very stressed.
It's not that the parents have become...
less loving, but they themselves are stressed.
It's that they're more stressed.
Mm-hmm. Your name?
Gabor Mate. That's for Hannah. Thank you. It's that they're more stressed.
Let me ask you another question, because you say that.
Also the community and the neighborhood and the clan and the tribe that used to support the parenting task has been eroded. So parents are left on their own more.
Yeah.
And most parents actually don't even see their kids most of the day. And this is why more kids are being diagnosed, because the conditions for healthy brain development are less and less available, despite all the loving that the parents have.
Yeah. That's very concerning, though, from a number of points of view, because it seems that that's going to be difficult to change how much support parents have in parenting. You know, it doesn't seem like our communities are the same as they were, 50 years ago. We don't have grandparents who live next to, their children and grandchildren as much. So it's a little bit different. And we're also, it seems to me that there are more and more children who are being abused or mistreated or neglected. And maybe it's just my skewed population I see of patients with addictions and eating disorders. But do you think that's true?
The numbers are certainly huge. And, of course, the more stressed people are, the more likely they are to abuse their kids. That's just how it is.
Mm-hmm.
Because they lose impulse control themselves. And they get aggressive. They get upset. And you take it on whoever's around, which is your kids. And then the other consequence of all that is that in the absence of working adult attachments, kids then form attachments to one another.
Mm-hmm.
So that now you have this increasing and inordinate influence on the peer group, on child development. So now you have, for the first time in history, you have immature creatures heavily influencing each other's development, which has got disastrous consequences for maturation and learning and development. And when it comes to addiction, of course, and that information is in my book, Hold On To Your Kids, Why Parents Have to Matter More Than Peers. And from the perspective of addiction, of course, the commonest context for being introduced to addictive substances or addictive behaviors is, of course, the peer group.
Mm-hmm.
So the more that parents lose their influence, even non-abusive, well-intentioned parents, the more they lose their influence because of their stresses in their lives and their relative absence in the child's life, the more the child falls under the influence of the peer group, the greater the risk of being introduced to addictive behaviors.
Mm-hmm. So how does the fetal environment in the womb affect addiction risk? Because you write about that in your book.
Well, again, the studies are now, beyond controversy that, as Dr. Robert Sapolsky at Stanford has said, that we're affected by the environment as soon as we have an environment.
Mm-hmm.
And we have an environment as soon as we're implanted in the womb.
Right.
And so we know now that mothers, for example, who are abused during pregnancy will have higher levels of the hormone cortisol in their placenta at birth, and the cortisol has a significant effect on the child's development in utero.
Mm-hmm.
And so that their infants are more likely years later to have developmental problems, which predispose to addictions. We know that we can stress pregnant animals in the laboratory, and their offspring will be more likely to use cocaine and alcohol when they become adults. Much information now has come along to show the negative impact of maternal stress And again, if you look at this, is a social issue. It's not just an individual issue. Because the more you stress people, the less support there is for pregnant women, the less community there is, the more people are exposed to economic uncertainty. If a woman is in a troubled or abusive relationship, that is all going to have an inevitable impact on the child's development.
Okay. So let me just, I'd like to just look at some of the populations that have very severe addictive issues. And this is, for example, the Native populations, like Native Americans and, you know, other Native populations. I know there was just a documentary on that Lise Ling did on the Native Americans and their high rates of alcoholism.
Well, you know, in Canada, it's the same thing. And in the Canadian Native, we don't call them Canadian Indians. They're called First Nations peoples, same population. But in Canada, in the Vancouver area where I worked, 30% of my clients were First Nations origin, Aboriginal origin, whereas they only make up about 2 or 3% of the Canadian population. And if you look at the prison population in Canada, and again, it's in many federal jails, like 40, 50% of the inmates are Native, whereas they only make up a small percentage of the population. And the suicide rate, the addiction rate, the alcoholism rate, the autoimmune disease rate, and all these things, you know, these are very high in First Nations communities. And historically, that wasn't the case.
Right.
You know, there was even alcohol in some areas of what is now New Mexico, I think, for example, before the coming of the Caucasians, but there was no alcoholism. The alcoholism is a response to being traumatized. And these people were, as a society, traumatized by the, let's face it, what amounted to the mass murder that was practiced upon them, particularly in the United States, by the loss of their lands and livelihood that occurred in both our countries, by the many ways in which they were unjustly dealt with, by the sexual exploitation of their women. Even now, Native Americans or Canadian Native Americans in the North, females, have a much higher risk of being raped than a white woman. And most of that is by non-Native men. But there is a lot of sexual abuse, too, in the Native communities. And all that began in Canada, at least, in the residential schools, where Native children were forcibly taken away from their parents. The community were forcibly destroyed. At age 3 or 4 or 5, these kids were taken away from their parents, forced to go to these residential schools, where they were beaten up for speaking their own language. And an alien culture was shoved down their throats. An alien religion was forced upon them. Their own ways were invalidated and declared inferior and forbidden even. And then on top of that, they were sexually abused for generations.
Yeah.
Under those conditions, people become traumatized. And unfortunately, what happens is that we pass our trauma on to the younger generation, especially when we have no longer learned how to parent because we were taken away from our own parents.
Yeah.
So that's
so it's,
a tragic story.
It seems
so
like a very complex, almost a public health issue. In the 14-plus years you've worked in this field, have you seen any changes that give you hope that this might be different?
Well, I see little change. Well, let me say, let me put it this way. I see both progress and real resistance of progress at the same time. Now, in Vancouver, we've established what's North America's only supervised injection site. People actually come there with their illegal drugs. They get to inject. They won't be arrested. And they do so under nursing supervision with clean needles, sterile water, alcohol swabs so they don't get infected quite nearly so much, and they won't pass infections onto one another like HIV and hepatitis C. And if they overdose, they're resuscitated. And that's a huge step forward in reducing the harm from addictions. But a lot of people have trouble with it, and the federal government even tried to shut it down. They were prevented from doing so by a vote of the Supreme Court of Canada just last November. So that's progress, as far as I'm concerned, towards working with these people in a compassionate and understanding fashion. At the same time, of course, you have the continuing war on drugs. And what you've got in the war on drugs, like Dr. Bessel van der Kolk, who's a professor at Boston University and a world expert on trauma, he says basically that 100% of the inmates of the federal institutions, of the criminal justice system in the states, began life as abused children, traumatized children.
Mm.
And so what we end up doing is we take children, we try and rescue kids if we can from abuse. We, as a society, we try to do that. The police try to do that. Authorities try to do that. But if we fail to do so, and the trauma then is visited upon them, and as adults then, or teenagers, they turn to drugs to soothe their pain, then we make them a social enemy, and we jail them, and we treat them terribly in jails.
Mm. So it almost sounds like, in many ways, we're back in the dark ages in this area, you know, that progress has been made in some areas. But when you describe it that way, it feels like, you know, we're just really primitive in our approaches to addiction.
Well, you know, we are terribly backward. We ignore science, the brain science that I've been talking about, the developmental science, the evidence of the adverse childhood experiences studies. We also ignore what we've learned in spiritual traditions, whether Buddhist or Christian or whatever have you, throughout the ages, that if you want people to transform, you have to treat them compassionately and with love.
Mm-hmm.
That's essentially the teaching of Buddha and Jesus, not to mention other great
spiritual teachers.
And so that you don't help people transform by further ostracizing and punishing them. You do it by giving them lots of compassion, lots of understanding, acceptance for who they are. And then you can see the transformation happening inside them. So we ignore all the evidence, and we ignore human experience, and we ignore our own hearts. It's a very heartless approach.
Yeah.
That as a society we visit on the drug addict. Then, of course, that reflects what? It reflects, I think, the inner recognition that so many of us have those tendencies, and we just don't want to face that.
Mm-hmm.
So we'd rather just cast out the devil by focusing our disapproval on the clearly identified drug addict.
We have just a couple minutes before the next break, and I just wondered how you were personally affected by the people you worked with.
Well, I really saw myself in them. I mean, I didn't see a major difference humanly and in terms of dysfunction, except that I'd been luckier in my life. I'd had certain stresses and traumas in my childhood, but nothing like what they had experienced.
Yeah.
You can't help but be moved by what happens to people, and you know, and in this kind of a field, people die. I mean, you know, people die of overdoses of HIV, and that has an effect, you know, and you miss people, you lose people, you mourn them. I also really liked my clients. They were really interesting people, often very creative, very sensitive. Underneath that hardened demeanor, there's very often tremendous vulnerability. Once they begin to trust you, that vulnerability becomes very apparent.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes I would find myself very judgmental of them, depending on, you know, despite what I know.
Yeah.
Those judgments just arise. And interestingly enough, of course, or not so surprisingly, it's when I was out of integrity in my own life, if I was indulging in one of my shopping sprees, for example, that's when I'd be most judgmental of my clients. That's when I had the least tolerance for what I saw as their weakness or their refusal to give it up, you know, give up their habits. So it was a complex relationship. I learned a lot from them as well. And I think I became a more compassionate human being with deeper understanding of human possibility and human suffering.
Okay. Thank you for sharing that with us. We're going to go to break now, and we'll be back in just a moment on The Vital Life with our guest, Dr. Gabor Mate, the author of In the Realm of Hungry Ghost.
Opinions, options, answers. Voice America Health and Wellness.
Have your resolutions to lose weight fallen flat? Get serious about reaching your healthy weight and actually changing your relationship with food and your body once and for all. The Anchor Weight Management Program, developed by Dr. Carolyn Coker Ross, is a unique whole-person approach to restoring your healthy body weight without sacrificing your joy in eating. This is a medically supervised, effective, safe, and realistic program. There are ongoing programs in the Denver area, or you can do the program at your own pace, in the privacy of your own home. For more information or to register, call 303-993-5468. That's 303-993-5468.
Step into a healthier you. Voice America Health and Wellness.
You're listening to The Vital Life, Awakening Your Full Potential with your host, Dr. Carolyn Coker Ross. If you have a question for Dr. Ross or her guests today, please call 1-866-472-5792. That's 1-866-472-5792. If you prefer to send an email, you can reach Dr. Ross at vitalliferadio@gmail.com. Now back to The Vital Life.
Thanks for coming back to The Vital Life. I wanted to just remind everybody that you can listen to our shows on iTunes and download podcasts of previous shows. Also, just to let you know, if you're interested in the upcoming weight management program, go to my website, www.findingyouranchor.com, and sign up for my newsletter. Or you can go to carolynrossmd.com. and sign up for the newsletter there. My guest next week will be Elizabeth DiBiase, and she's going to be talking on eating gluten-free. My guest today is Dr. Gabor Mate. He's a physician, a best-selling author. He has worked in family practice, palliative care, and addictions. And we've been talking about his most recent book, In the Realm of Hungry Ghosts, Close Encounters with Addiction. I want to make sure that you know how to find out more information about him. Just go to his website, www.drgabormate.com. Let me spell that out, drgabormate.com. And you can hear past lectures of his. You can see his schedule of upcoming events and find out more about his previous books. So, Dr. Mate, before we went to break, we were continuing to talk about what it takes to heal addictions, but I wanted to just take a little turn, deviate, and talk a little bit about childhood ADHD, because there's so many children now who are being diagnosed with this and put on all of these medications, and it just really, in some cases, breaks my heart to see what happens to them when they're treated in this way. Can you tell us a little bit about your philosophy in that and approach?
Well, again, the medical profession tends to look upon the condition as a genetic, mm-hmm. transmitted disease. But if that were the case, we wouldn't be seeing all these increases, because genes don't change in a population in a short period of time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, not even over hundreds of years.
Right.
So in Canada, the number of, and I know in the States right now, a huge number of kids are, I think there's 3 million kids on stimulants in the United States right now, at last
right.
count. And in Canada, the numbers of being diagnosed and treated keep going up and up and up as well.
Mm-hmm.
If we understand that this is not a genetic disease, even though I have it and a couple of my kids have been diagnosed, it's not a genetic disease.
Mm-hmm.
What actually happens is that the child's brain, again, develops an interaction with the environment, and the circuits of attention and impulse regulation, which are impaired in ADHD, and the dopamine circuits, which I mentioned earlier. In fact, when we give people dextrodrine or Ritalin or any of these stimulant drugs, what we're striving to do is to elevate dopamine levels in the brain. And those circuits, again, don't develop when the parents are stressed or distracted. So the more there's social stress on parents, the more there is parental distraction, lack of ability of the parent to be present emotionally with the child because of their own problems and stresses and lack of support, the more childhood developmental brain issues you're going to see. Because it's not a genetic disease, though, and because the human brain can develop new circuits even later on in life, and especially through our childhood, given the right circumstances, the question we have to ask is not how do we fix the symptom, with the drug, with the medication, but how do we help this child develop? So if we understand that the child's brain can develop even later, then the question we'll be asking is, what kind of environment do we have to create in our homes and in our schools and in our kindergartens and wherever children are looked after to help promote their brain development? That means whether or not we use medications, we recognize that medications are not the answer. Mm-hmm. Because medications at the very most help you with symptoms, and that may sometimes be necessary, but they do nothing to promote development. So again, it's the child's environment that we have to look at, how we see the child. And these kids, of course, it's very parallel to drug addicts because these kids are either medicated or we try and control their behaviors by means of punishments.
Right.
And we don't realize that the child is not deliberately behaving in certain ways, that the impulsive behaviors reflect a lack of brain development. And then the question we have to ask ourselves again is, what kind of conditions does the child need for healthy brain development? We would be punishing or criticizing the child. We'd be understanding the source of the behaviors, and we'd be promoting an environment that can support healthy behaviors and encourage development. And that's possible mm-hmm. with that understanding. But of course, most of that time, the child is diagnosed. All that happens is they get a prescription, and that's the end of the treatment.
Right.
You know. So that's the subject of my book. The book is entitled Scattered: How ADD Originates and What You Can Do About It. That's the American title of it. And that's the outline. That's a short outline of what I say in that book. And, of course, ADD becomes a major risk factor for addiction later on, too, unless you handle it well.
I had an experience with my youngest son where four of his friends were diagnosed with either behavior problems or ADHD,
yeah.
And one who was the most severe was finally kicked out of the school system, thank goodness, because he was sent to a smaller school where there was like a 5-to-1 or 8-to-1 student-to-teacher ratio, and his
right.
whole life changed.
Yes.
And it was amazing. You know,
yes.
It wasn't about the medication. It was about what, just as you said, the environment.
Absolutely. So, if I can trace my own ADHD back to the fact that I was a stressed infant, a Jewish infant in Budapest, Hungary in 1944 under mm-hmm. Nazi occupation and all the traumas that my parents, as you can imagine, mm-hmm. endured and all the anxiety, depression, and terror that my mother went through as she was looking after me. And in a situation like that, the scattering of attention actually becomes a defensive technique on part of the child. Because when the stress is too much and the child can't get away from it, how does he deal with it? By splitting his attention so he's not so aware of it. It's just a God-given or a nature-given defensive technique.
But you said you were not diagnosed until 52.
No, I wasn't. I wasn't because I'm not the most severe case.
Yeah.
I mean, there's different severities of it. And
So how do you make changes in your life to help heal the ADHD?
Well, meditation is important for me.
Okay.
I haven't done this very successfully, but not taking on too much stress in my life. Working on my emotional issues so that I'm not, and I've been very much affected by that early childhood experience in terms of my emotional behaviors. Working on my relationships, healthy eating, regular exercise, all that stuff is important.
Okay.
In the case of my kids now, they grew up in a home where the father was a workaholic, ADD-driven physician,
mm-hmm.
and the mother was stressed as a result.
Mm-hmm.
So
right.
Now their brains are affected by that environment. So we do pass it on generationally, but we don't do it genetically.
Mm-hmm.
And,
so
and,
have you been able to help them to change their environment as you've learned about this?
Well, as I learned about it, the parenting environment in our home did get better,
mm-hmm.
and
okay.
that made a huge difference for them. Now they're adults, and they have to take on their own healing. I can support them as best I can, but
mm-hmm.
once you're an adult, you need to just take it on yourself.
So let's go back a little bit to the patients you worked with addictions, and many of them you describe in your book, In the Realm of Hungry Ghosts, you describe that they also had pretty severe mental illness. Is that also a result of the same etiology?
Yeah.
And how did that affect your treatment?
Again, if you look at the adverse childhood experience studies, you see that the risk of depression, anxiety, psychosis, they all go up with childhood adversity. Mm-hmm. And ADHD, of course, I mean, probably 20-30% of my clients, or probably 20%, would have had ADHD unrecognized and untreated. Mm-hmm. You know, so you have to take that into account. And, of course, to the person with ADHD, when they do crystal meth, it's like they're self-treating. They're self-medicating.
Right.
Because crystal meth is a stimulant, just like dextrodine or Ritalin is.
Right.
It's more dangerous, and it has a much greater effect, but nevertheless, it gives them that dopamine surge that they're looking for.
Mm-hmm.
So when you actually look at addictions from that point of view, you realize that many addictive behaviors or the use of substances are desperate attempts on the part of the individual to regulate underlying mental health conditions.
Hmm.
So people will use alcohol to treat their depression or their social anxiety,
mm-hmm.
Or their ADHD for that matter. In one study, 40% of male alcoholics were shown to have ADHD. People will use cocaine as an antidepressant because cocaine, like Prozac, elevates serotonin levels in the brain.
Mm.
People will use opiates to self-medicate PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. And as we know, large numbers of the veterans who come back from Iraq and Afghanistan suffering from PTSD will gravitate towards opiate use.
Mm-hmm.
So we have to recognize these underlying conditions that people are self-treating. Of course, I'm not advocating that they should self-treat that way because they lead to more problems. Mm-hmm. But in the short term, it's their attempt to solve a problem in their lives, which is what my original point was. So we have to actually look at these underlying and accompanying mental health conditions and treat them. And of course, it's also true that some of the drugs can further exacerbate or cause mental health issues. So people who are heavily into cocaine or crystal meth, they can develop psychoses.
Right.
Even some children who are, or youth who are genetically predisposed in this case, if they do cannabis, that can trigger psychosis for them. So that then you have, but in most cases you have at least a double problem of both an addiction issue and a mental health issue that either preceded or followed upon the use of drugs.
Okay. So how have your views been accepted in the addiction field or in the medical world, medical system?
Well, the success of the book indicates that certainly amongst the public, there's a lot of appreciation for what I'm saying because it drives at people's experience. Yes. I do get invitations to speak to medical groups. I just spoke last week at the California Society of Addiction Medicine's conference in San Francisco.
Mm-hmm.
And what I had to say was well received, and many physicians who had read the book expressed real appreciation for it. But I wouldn't say that on the official and global level, these views are much accepted or even taken into account.
Mm-hmm.
But that's just how it is, and
yeah.
I expect that to improve with time. What I do know is I get a lot of invitations to speak to addiction workers, non-medical health personnel,
mm-hmm.
And certainly I get lots of people with addictions who write to me and tell me that the book changed their lives, and I have difficulty taking credit for that, but clearly
it's very gratifying, I would think, right?
It is, and people, you know, who find themselves mirrored or understood by that book, that'll mm-hmm. certainly help them. So in terms of the profession, there's some acceptance and interest, and that's really, really gratifying. And
mm-hmm.
I think, however, as I think you understand too, it's a very conservative profession, which is very slow to change. And even the adverse childhood experience studies, although
yeah.
they've been widely reported and nobody's ever refuted them or even questioned them much, they're not incorporated into medical practice. And that's the material and brain development I told you about. It's not controversial. It's just state-of-the-art brain science. It's not yet taught in any medical school that I know about. I may be wrong, but certainly.
Well, we just have a couple minutes now before we end, and I just wanted to ask you, what is your vision of what it would take to heal people with addictions?
Well, we have to understand two things. One is that the problems that led to the addiction are lifelong issues. The lack of self-esteem, the shame that the abused child has because they all believe it's their own fault or that they deserved it somehow. The impulse control problems because of inadequate brain development, the poor sense of relationship, the distrust of authority figures, and the generally negative take on the world. They can't help it. This is ingrained in them in childhood. So these are, you have to deal with all this stuff if you're going to have somebody overcome addiction, number one. Number two, the mental health issues. Number two, the drug use itself changes the brain in negative ways. So after a period of drug use, whether it's alcohol or heroin or cocaine, you see certain negative brain changes on brain scans. Mm-hmm. And that means that healing is not going to be an overnight affair. Putting somebody into a detox, helping them clean up from the drug, and then shoving them back into the street does nothing for them.
Mm-hmm.
Because inevitably, almost inevitably, they're going to fall back into drug use. So the treatment and the brain changes that addiction causes will themselves take a long time to be reversed, during which time people need compassionate care, nutrition, patience, counseling, love support, no judgment,
okay.
Strain. Things that we don't provide drug addicts.
Yeah, and I'm going to have to stop you there on that
sure.
note. And I think just personally, this has been a really wonderful experience of talking with you. And I want to thank you for being on the show and sharing this important knowledge and understanding of addictions. So
well,
thank you.
Pleasure to speak with you as well. And thanks for the interest.
Yeah. So I'm sorry to say that's all the time we have today. I want to thank my listeners to The Vital Life, Awakening Your Full Potential. And until next week, I wish you good health and vitality.
We hope you've enjoyed listening this week to The Vital Life, Awakening Your Full Potential. Please be sure to join Dr. Carolyn Coker-Ross again next Friday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time, 10 a.m. Pacific Time on the Voice America Health and Wellness Channel. Until then, have a vital week.